Hello and welcome to the Art Department podcast. My name is Jan Oshaw and with me again, Emmanuel Shu. And we are at episode 25 and we want to continue one of the series we started last year, which is about inspiration. And this episode will be about cinematography, movies, something like that. Anyway, we're going to dive a bit into one of the areas of entertainment that is very near and dear to our heart. Something where we spent a lot of time working on, so which is the movies. And we picked kind of our top five, and we initially made it about cinematography, but I think along the line we realized it's really much more than that. There's always a very personal story, I think, attached to every one of the movies we chose. So it's not really purely about cinematography, right? So there's going to be a lot more than it. So do you want to start with your first one?
Sure. I mean, I'm going to have a bunch of, I think, movies that most people probably don't know much about, and Good. Some that are super popular. So I don't know.
Same for
me. I mean, it looks like you already have something loaded up there.
Yeah. So in the background, I have the first one. And I think it's everybody is familiar with it, right? And I do hope most people have seen it. And that, of course, is Alien, right? The first one.
Yeah. And, so, you know, that came out when I was really, really young. And I remember going to a friend's house and, you know, it had a real big impact on me. I think as it does most people, right?
Yeah,
I mean, I didn't see this in the theater, but it scared hell out of me.
Oh, yeah.
At my friend's, he's like, oh, my God, check this out. Check this out. And I was like, well, what is it? What is it? And then we watched it and we couldn't stop. But it freaked me the hell out. I couldn't sleep for like nights after that. But, you know, I think it also clicked something in me, you know, just the way he used the camera and the light and, you know, all because of, you know, budgetary reasons and just because that he wanted to film it that way. I mean, it wasn't a very high budget film.
Right.
So, you know, he really showed like sci-fi in a way where, you know, most people hadn't shown it before. You know, it was always, you know, like the previous movies were quite sort of funny.
Right.
You know, I don't even know that, but I mean, because I was just watching another Alien documentary called Memory.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I saw that one, yeah.
And it's like, you know, the previous movies are all like almost like a comedy. And Ridley came and just killed it with his vision.
Yeah, it was quite
obviously with Giger.
Yeah, you know, yeah, yeah. That was a match made in heaven, I think, right? I mean, it's very true.
Yeah.
I mean, there was Star Trek, which I think had a big impact in the 60s. And then that year also the first Star Trek came out. But that is, of course, a very different kind of future. And then, Star Wars are usually put very much in the draw of fantasy, not really science fiction. But other than that, I mean, you had the monster sci-fi movies in the 50s, right? But then after that, there wasn't
really much.
There was a bit of that cerebral kind of like body snatchers movies in the 70s with like mind control. But then, creature feature. I mean, this is pretty much the birth of the modern space horror, right?
Yeah, and not only was it, you know, the horror aspect that got me, it was also just the fact that I think there was so much drama in it, you know, and I was feeling these things before I even knew what these things were.
Right, right.
You know, I didn't know what composition, cinematography or any of that.
But
you
it's
know,
subconscious,
I didn't know. What was I, like 10, 11, something? Yeah. You know, I was young, you know, I had no idea any of this stuff.
Right.
But, you know, it really had an impact on me. And now looking back and understanding it, it makes you appreciate it even more. You know, I mean, it's hard not to, right? I mean, I think it's, you know, you look at some of the frames and it's like, you can't, I mean, not only was a great, you know, story, how it was told, how it was acted,
right.
But it, you know, in the composition of things, the lighting of things, the cinematography side of things is just pretty amazing. I still look at it and go, wow, you know. Yeah, I mean, of course, most people do, right?
I mean, because everything is practical. That is another thing. Yeah, right?
If you told me that movie is coming out in a month, I wouldn't question it.
Exactly, right.
You know, I wouldn't be like, oh my God, that looks so old. I mean, that's a testament, you know, like simplicity and design, not only in the design of it, but the shots, the lighting, you know, how they frame stuff. So this is definitely one of my sort of, you know, go-to favorites, but I mean, you know, everybody, you know.
Yeah, no, I watch it a couple of times. I watch it at least once a year. There's something about, again, the pacing, the cinematography, everything that just works so well together. And the funny thing is that I think it was, I don't know if it's true, but I think it was mentioned in one of the Dune documentary about the Dune movie in the 70s that was never made. And Jodorowsky's Dune. And he assembled like a crazy all-star cast, not in front of the camera, but like Salvador Dali, whatever, but also behind the camera. And a lot of the department got scooped up by Ridley Scott and then made its way into Alien. So, I think Giga as well, but Mobius, now I keep on forgetting who did the hard surface design. What's his name? Who did the DeLorean as well? Now I can't. He recently passed away. Now I'm really stuck here.
Ron Cobb.
Yeah, exactly. Cobb. There's a lot of talented people that got kind of shifted from one project to the other, and maybe, I don't know, that's a testament to the power of a good team here.
And just so that people know, like, check out Jodorowsky's Dune, because that is a really good documentary.
Oh yeah,
and
it's funny.
Very, very, very interesting. I think a lot of people don't know about it.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's crazy.
That they, you know, it's like this Magnificent Seven of filmmaking. You know, he went all over the place to find the best people to work on this film, like including Salvador Dali. It's
yeah, as Baron Harkonnen, right? I don't think the new actor can beat that.
And it's just completely crazy, and I laugh my butt off, but I mean, it was a great documentary, so check that out if you guys have a chance. Mm. That's a really, really good and interesting documentary.
The one you mentioned, Memory, the one that came out last year, right, about Alien, that's very good as well.
That's very good.
I mean, looking at this frame, and one of the funny things is that Ridley Scott, if anything, is a very resourceful director, right? So in order to make everything, this is a model, right? And in order to make everything look bigger, he used his kids in spacesuits for the scene where they exit the spaceship and walk around here. I love that fact.
It's nuts what he would do. Yeah. I mean, it's so smart, you know? Mm-hmm. Can you make these any bigger? Just like,
maybe a little bit. I think this is the biggest.
It's just you know, the way that the, you know, he's defined like what space ship corridors should look like for the next how many.
Yeah, that is so awesome. Great. I mean, the design is still being ripped off. Or
exactly, and the way they use the light and everything, it's just
that's true.
Can't say enough about it.
Exactly. And we'll get to another one of Ridley Scott's movies as well.
Well, why don't you just jump to it?
Yeah,
right now?
Let me jump to it. And of course, I mean, it's almost a cliche, the movie, but nevertheless, I thought I would mention it.
Damn,
and of course,
Jan gets the full screen. I get the baby screen.
No, it's because I have sourced better resolution images. That's all it is. Anyway, I even found the title card. Just so I have it up here, so people aren't confused what I'm talking about here. So it's of course the infamous Blade Runner, the movie that Scott made after Alien, it was a box office flop, and then kind of took on a life of its own later on through VHS and DVD.
And now it's like a cult.
And now it's like a cult movie, and like one of the probably most referenced science fiction movies ever made. People I'm sure know it. People who watch this podcast, I'm sure they know it. If they don't know, then you have to really watch it. So it's kind of like transporting a film noir, like a gangster story, into the future, with incredible production design and a look to it, which was largely supposedly designed by one person, which was Sid Mead. I don't know how much of that is true, how much he really is responsible for every aspect of this production. I mean, there was the funny thing, right? I mean, I loved the movie just for its cinematography, and when I watched it first, which was probably my early teens when I found out about it and watched it. And I couldn't even, again, like you, I couldn't even articulate why I liked this movie. And my parents said, like, oh, this movie is so boring, like nothing's happening. But I was like, no, but I like it, right? I couldn't really articulate what it was. And so I watched it again and again. And later on, of course, when all the documentaries and everything came out, I revisited a lot again and tried to pay more attention to all the little details. And it was quite, again, about the learning about the resourcefulness of a director, of how he had a very tight schedule, low budget compared to today's standards, and how he had to make do with a set that was often used for something completely different. And all the street scenes are basically shot shot in the Warner lot or whatever. So you have a lot of backgrounds that have been stand-ins for, I don't know, Western shows and whatever. And he had to like set dress everything. And they had to shoot, always when it was dark, rainy, and full of steam, to hide all the cheapness of the background and to really make it look like it's a different place. Let me cycle through some of these. And there's of course a lot of close-ups. Again, it kind of opened a new world to me, to say that not everything is a, I mean, everything is deliberate in the frame, but not everything comes out of like a blank white paper, and then you dream up whatever you think. It's a lot of it is born out of the circumstance of the production, and the materials, the budget you have available, and the resources, and then you have to just make do with whatever you have and try to achieve the best result. Right? It's not always you have like an endless amount of money and the greatest mind in the universe to dream up whatever out of a blank page, but it's really about taking what you have and working with it. And I mean, there's stuff like here's the Millennium Falcon in the background with a bit of like greebles on top and all these kind of things, just because that's what they had, which is always quite funny looking back at it. So there's a myriad of documentaries available on this movie, and I highly recommend guys watching it. And
let me ask you a question real quick. So in your terms, what do you think cinematography is?
What
does it mean to you? I guess it's nothing official.
And I'll come to that later as well. For me, cinematography is about, mainly it's problem solving. Mainly it's, how do I tell a story? How can I have every frame be subservient to the story and the story I want to tell? And that story is not only in the traditional sense of like character A talks to character B, but it's also about, how do I tell the story of this dystopian future, right? That also needs to be apparent. And I mean, there's some not so good photography in a sense of like, it doesn't tell the story right. It's pure eye candy. It doesn't have any purpose. And that's when you get like very polished products that have no heart and no soul, that doesn't connect with the viewer. And then there's cinematography that is very utility driven, that is not necessarily like the prettiest you have ever seen, but that still manages to tell a good story. And then where it really gets interesting is where the director has such a tight grasp on the story he wants to tell that he can actually take, or the director of cinematography can take that whole thing to a next level by really making it beautiful. And then when you have just such a, when you have like a really good balance of a beautiful product and that achieves exactly what it sets out to do, like tell the good story, then you have something really, I think, special on your hands. But if the balance tips to one or the other, you end up with a inferior product, I think. I don't know. That's just my thoughts. What do you think?
No. Yeah, it's good because I think a lot of people, you know, they wonder, you know, they may, you know, because I've mentored a lot of people and taught people and I said, hey, you know, you really need to look into cinematography. I mean, even with Scott from last week, I would say, well, look into cinematography. And I think I realize a lot of people, especially illustrators, they don't really understand or really get cinematography because it's not really sort of their medium. But, you know, when you're trying to get like a film job or trying to do concepts for films, I mean, you kind of have to understand that. Otherwise, it's really hard to make something look very cinematic.
Right.
Because you have to dissect what I mean, you know, like, I mean, obviously you're not trying to be a director in the sense that you're not, you know, pulling a whole movie together. So you're trying to be a cinematographer kind of to make sure you're telling the story with the right angle, lensing, lighting, all those things, you know, right. Camera work. Although, you know, in a still, you won't see too much of that. So I think it's really crucial, and I agree with what you said about, I mean, that's pretty much what I think it is, but I think it's actually very important that people know how important that is.
And how difficult it is.
Because, I mean, it's just, if you don't understand this, then, and you want to work in film, it ultimately, the more cinematic you can make your stuff, I think the more the director will look at your work or the production designer and say, well, you're a good fit because, you know, I can trust you to make it look like a film.
I mean, there's also, I think, a lot of things of like mistaking to make something cinematic. The mistake is to rely on the technicalities of it. To say like, oh, you need a certain aspect ratio, you need a certain lens, you need a certain this, a certain that, when really that's not the case. I mean, there's so many examples in the history of film that something, they look all cinematic, but it's they have different aspect ratios, different lenses, they're black and white, they're in color, they're this, they're that, they're very washed out, like lots of grain, others are very clean. So there's really... there's a certain look to it, but it only is the secondary aspect, I think.
Yeah, as long as it serves the story first.
Exactly.
You know, that's, anyway, let's keep a move on because we still got a whole bunch.
Oh yeah, we still got a whole bunch into.
But I mean, you know, obviously Blade Runner, I mean, you guys can check out the films more in detail.
Oh yeah, and you should watch them. You should, you know, watch
for
everything.
Yourself and watch them. Yeah. I doubt they haven't watched Blade Runner.
I mean, you can't work in this industry and not have watched it. Sorry. Okay, let's get to your next one, and we're going a bit out on a limb here, so I hope some people know these movies. I know them.
So A Better Tomorrow, I mean, you know, if there is a film that made the, I mean, this is just more of that it made a big impact on me. And this is the first, I think the first movie that had really, really heavy impact on me as a person.
Could you give us a bit of background when it came out and who the director was?
John Woo.
John Woo, yeah. Late 80s, yeah, right? So 87, 88, I think.
Yeah. I think it was 86.
Oh, a bit earlier? Okay. Well, maybe it was the second
part. Yeah, it was a bit earlier, somewhere around there. But I can tell you that, you know, this is the first time I saw a movie that I actually felt, you know, the friendships and, you know, all the things that actually happened. I remember all the shots that I have on here, exactly what happened. And it actually shaped me a lot in, you know, my relationships. You know, in high school, I went to boarding school, and it was like, you know, this was a big deal to me, this movie. So, So in no other, I mean, that's really what hit me on this one. And you know, looking back, it's not like the most cinematic movie. Mm-hmm. But I think whatever it did, it served, you know, the story, and it really, I mean, it really made an impact on me.
Right. So it's like, I mean, it's
have you've seen this?
I've seen all three of them. The second and third are not that great, right? But yeah, they made a huge impact in Hong Kong, and of course in Greater Asia as well. It was very popular in Japan, in Korea. Well, this started at the time.
Mafia films.
Yeah, exactly, right? So it was like, it was definitely, I mean, John Woo at that point was already established in Hong Kong as one of the action directors. But it was basically the starting point for, I think, Chow Yun-fat, right? And Leslie Cheung to become superstars in their own right. And I mean, it's a gangster family story, right? Set in 80s Hong Kong.
Well, it's really about Chow Yun-fat and his sort of brother,
right?
Like real life brother, and then his, you know, mafia brother, mm-hmm. and it's about their relationship and, you know, how he comes back from, you know, I'm not gonna ruin it for anybody, but it's just it's a really great story, mm-hmm. and I would recommend anybody to go see it. Although I'm not sure that I would say, wow, well, you know, look at it for it's all cinematography, because, you know, that I still look at, well, I mean, on the next one, I can say that that had a lot of impact mm-hmm. on me in a cinematography sense. But this one was just the story got me.
Exactly.
And there's something to be said about, you know, about that.
But, right.
What's your next one?
I'm going to jump around a bit, but I'm going to go a bit more chronologically. The earlier experiences I have are all very Hollywood focused. And so the next one I want to talk about is, like you can see here, if I can get this to work properly, Raiders of the Lost Ark or Indiana Jones Part 1. I've hesitated a lot about which movies I should show here, because again, this is a very obvious choice. A lot of people have seen it. But nevertheless, it had a big impact on me as a kid. I mean, that's when I first saw it. In terms of, it's a good question. I mean, it's, I think I saw it before I saw Blade Runner, actually. And it just has such a strong, and like, to me, this is what, when I was growing up, to me, this is what movies were like. Like, this is what I grew up with. This is like the personification of like Hollywood to me. Like this was what really got me interested in movies. And I always, in the beginning, I always thought how natural it looked, when of course there's nothing natural about any of it. Right. So, I mean, everything is in studio. Everything is fake. All the lights are exactly where you want them to go. A lot of it was like matte paintings and stuff like that. But to me, that was really what the magic of movies was for me about. Kind of like this complete make-believe world. I could completely believe in. Of course, there's some fantastic cinematography by Douglas Slocum here. The play with shadows, the play with light, the play of like this kind of transition from something you would expect like in the old days of Hollywood, but going into kind of like a new era of the blockbuster, and being very aware of the tradition of where cinema and this kind of stuff came from and where it needed to go. And I mean, we still draw so much from movies like that, but this is really kind of like what it was about for me. And I mean, I still watch this movie once a year, and I can't wait to, I mean, once my kids are a bit older, I'm like, this is the kind of stuff I want to show.
Oh, go back
them.
One? Go back one?
Oh, yeah. That is one of the most famous.
So this is the painting by the famous Mike Pangrazio, who actually came to help or came to teach me at on Hellboy.
Nice.
So that's the, so he did that matte painting on glass. But yeah, I mean, so for you is Raiders, for me is The Last Crusade.
I mean, really?
I don't know why that one has a special place for me. I don't know why. That's the one I watch every year.
It's an interesting
or at least
one.
A couple times a year.
I love all three of them. I don't even want to talk about the fourth one.
No. The fourth one doesn't even
But there is something about, I mean, this is like the opening sequence is one of my all-time favorites of anything. Any movie ever made. Like the opening sequence, and without really any words spoken, the characterization of Indiana Jones. And that one is just absolute magic for me. That without any words spoken, without really him having to do anything, you know everything this person is about. And that is just pure like mastery for me.
I mean, everybody's going to have
Of course. Right. But for, I mean, for me, it's like Indiana Jones 1. For me, it's like the first Star Wars, A New Hope. Like I say it openly, I'm not a big fan of Empire. That for me is where Star Wars got silly. But the first one is really, I mean, it's always kind of like the first one, the first movie for me. When it's fresh, when it's new, when there was no idea of like, oh, let's make a franchise out of this, right? The first Matrix, let's have our whole.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to bring Star Wars. I was like, you know, because that's like everybody, you know, I mean, that's the first sort of thing that, that you can relate back to sci-fi and I saw in the theater, but I was like, that's, you know, that's everybody's seen that
one. Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to.
Cool. Okay, so let's go back to yours. There's still a lot to see. And I mean, that one is also one of my favorites.
All right, well, yeah. So let's go. So this is The Big Blue by Luc Besson.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it came at a time, again, that I, you know, when I saw it, I was really touched by it. Because I grew up in, you know, water and doing a lot of water sports and swimming and all that stuff. And with the ocean, I had a bond. And I think this movie really kind of portrayed that, you know, to a certain sense. I mean, he, you know, bond with sea creatures and just, you know, being one with your inner self and being able to do the things that you're destined to do. I also at that time I was already kind of doing photography and I really started already to appreciate, I actually really enjoyed the cinematography in this film as well as the content and how the story was told. But I mean, I thought it was just amazing, you know, how he framed things and just, you know, how you could take free diving or show it in a way where, you know, it's just like, I've never seen that before, you know? And you know, I just really enjoy, and you know, we were talking about like the bedroom scene.
Do you have a frame here? Yeah. Oh yeah, here.
Yeah. So you know, it's a, you know, he's in a dream here. But I mean, it's just a lot of stuff that, you know, this is like back in the like late 80s.
Yeah. 88. Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, you know, a lot of this stuff is not, you know, there's no CG.
Yeah, then. It's all practical. Yeah.
And it's just really well done. And it you know, like we were saying, it really served the story. You know, all the stuff, you know, the how it was framed and the lights that were used. And I just, you know, I still look at the movie again and I still feel it. So this is definitely one that's close to home for me.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, that's it's a great movie. It's not forgotten, but it's like it definitely took a step back after Luc Besson's explosion in popularity, and I think most people will know him for like The Professional or Fifth Element, like we talked about yesterday, but.
Was this before The Professional?
Oh yeah, yeah, way before. Professional was 94.
Yeah, so I mean, he wasn't that well known on this one.
Yeah, I mean, in France, maybe he was quite big because I mean, La Femme Nikita or Subway. I mean, they were really. I think they were big hits in France, no? And I think at that point, it took maybe for a director a bit longer to get internationally known and drawn into Hollywood. Back then, I mean, now it happens a lot faster. But I mean, I knew him for sure before the Professional came out. Because I saw that one in cinema, I remember. Yeah, I mean, for me, this movie is really a lot about, I think I mentioned that to you yesterday as well, about the marriage of music to the image, because it has evocative classical, not classical, but like a classic soundtrack by Jean-Michel Jarre. And it's really, I mean, you cannot see this movie without the soundtrack. It's impossible. It's like so intermingled.
Yeah, yeah. And please, if you haven't seen this, go see it. It really is worth it. I can't say enough about it. And yeah, I still remember the music right now. So it's exactly. Yeah.
It's a good one.
All right.
I'm very happy you brought that one up. That is really good. So I'm gonna go to the last one of the Hollywood bunch here. And it's more like, again, the movie is kind of like not in itself the best ever the director did, but it's kind of symptomatic for a certain time in my life and a certain
well, just say who the director is.
Yeah, we have Seven here by David Fincher. Really his breakthrough after Alien 3 didn't go so well, but it kind of I like Alien 3 actually.
He
will not talk about it. There's an unapproved director's cut that's like half an hour longer, which I think is actually a lot better than the original, but it's a different thing. But anyway, so after I think making a few more music videos, he finally I think he's still best known for this one, or maybe Fight Club. I don't know. It's for me, this is all that 90s Hollywood is about. I mean, this is still one of the best Hollywood movies I think ever made. And what I came to admire is the precision, the perfectionism in pretty much every frame of this movie. How incredibly well done it is, I think the director of photography is the son of the guy who did Blade Runner, so there is a certain, I think, a DNA in both of these movies that link them together in a certain sense. And I mean,
you know, it's go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry. No. Yeah, for me, it's like the incredible precision and incredible beauty for what is essentially a very ugly movie, ugly in its thematic and its hopelessness and everything. And I mean, down to even the darkest frame, everything is incredibly deliberate and exact and very rich. Anyway.
You know what I was going to say was just that, you know, obviously I remember this movie, and this is definitely not a movie I'm watching every year just because it's freaking.
Yeah.
Like, I, you know, I'm not going to give any spoilers, but it's just one of those things where it really, the choice in cinematography and lighting and palette completely put me in a place of like discomfort. But it was meant for a purpose. It was done to make you feel that way, and I still remember the shots. I still remember the rain.
Yeah, exactly.
I still remember all the time. It's, you can't forget it, and that is really successful. And I think that if you can, you know, have your work reflect some of that, wow. You know, that's, you know, because I think a lot of people don't realize how much color grading and palette, lighting, composition, all these things have so much to do with your image.
Right.
That it's, you know, that it's just, it is a big part, and it really served the story, because they were very deliberate in making, not only framing it perfectly, but putting you in a place where you felt horrible.
Yeah, and I mean, later I found out a couple of things about Fincher himself, how he loves to do takes again and again and again until he has the perfect framing, the perfect performance that he wants, and it will tire out everybody, apparently, as he goes to great lengths to capture that. And even then afterwards, he will do a lot of adjustment in the frame to get exactly the kind of stuff he wants. And that showed me just how much effort it will take. You can't just take a picture and then that's it. You have to do he does a lot of work afterwards to get it exactly to the way he wants to. And
sometimes I wonder, you know, because I always had this confusion, and I think probably a lot of people have this confusion, is like, how much of this, of cinematography, is the cinematographer, and how much of it is the director?
A good question. Right. I think it's a bit of everything, no? I mean,
because if you're the director and you see something being framed and you don't like it, you're gonna say something, right? I mean, you're gonna be like, "Hey, I don't."
But
like,
I mean,
that.
you need to trust the people you hire, right? And you really have to have a tight relationship with them to say like, okay, he needs to do as I want him to do, as even though I'm not constantly looking over his shoulder, right? So that's I think why a lot of times, like the duo of like a director and director of photography, they meet very early on in their careers. They kind of often stick together for a long time if they feel like the there's a lot of synergy. There's a lot of they complement each other a lot, so you will see that.
It's no accident.
Exactly.
Up film after film together, exactly. Because they have a shorthand now. Okay, yeah.
Exactly. So that happens as well.
But yeah, look at these frames. Like, you can't choose a bad frame.
Yeah, it's like everything is like so amazing, but of course it's painstakingly done. This is not an accident, right? But anyway, so I'm gonna stop talking about Hollywood now and. Do you want me to do another one? I think I have a few more than you do.
I can do. Go to The Killer.
Okay,
let's do that.
Let's go down here.
So, you know, The Killer, another very sort of poignant movie, a Hong Kong movie, and this one. I was already going to college, I think, and doing photography, and I really appreciated it. And there was this one frame, which if you'll scroll down, like four images like that.
Oh, one, two, three.
The blue
this one. Ah, okay.
Yeah. So you can just zoom in a little bit on that. Yeah. So like that image, I saw it. I could really. I for some reason I keep remembering this image, and I really wanted to start learning how to do silhouette, you know, and trying to get a feel of things that feel like this at that time. And I would, you know, use my photography and I'll try my best to do, you know, stuff like that, and it showed through in my photography. And this movie really inspired me to explore more. Like if you go to the next frame, like this one too, I mean, it was just like, and I still remember the music that was playing. I still remember what he was saying. Now of course, you know, John Woo is a little over the top with the, you know, all the pigeons, and
especially later on. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it just gets a little bit too much, and the story itself has issues. There's some parts that I can't forget, and it's kind of built me up in terms of the way I like to do my framing. And I think that all the things you've seen me bring up, it's kind of this big pot of, you know, stuff that's mixed all together, and it's created somebody like me that does what I do. So this movie had a lot of impact, you know, cinematography wise, but also, you know, also there were parts of the story that I enjoyed, but ultimately it was a little too over the top. I mean, you've seen it, right?
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I mean,
there's great, great scenes in there. But yeah, that was a bit late. That was in the mid 90s, right? Mm-hmm. I think, or early 90s. And then he also did Hard Boiled, which was great, I thought. But yeah, there's really, and then the infamous, always like candles in a church with pigeons, that kind of thing.
He even brought that to like a Mission Impossible 2 with the pigeons.
Oh,
and
yeah,
I was like,
yeah, yeah.
No.
That was a bit too much.
Was it pigeons or doves? Doves or something. One of those.
White flying animals. But yeah, yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one.
Yeah. If you watch it, you know, take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
But I mean, this shaped me is all I can say.
Yeah, no, that's
very
important.
And I think I only have one
more,
so we could either just do that.
We'll get to it because I also have one of the director.
Okay, go.
So I'm gonna now, so mid 90s was a bit when I not turned my back on Hollywood, but I really looked at to like what more is there, what more. And so I got into Asian cinema out of all things, because I think there was just a. It just came up. It was more known. There was certain movies that won awards internationally that then got more attention and distribution in Europe, and one of them was of course Fireworks by the infamous comedian turned director Takeshi Kitano. So that won a Golden Lion in Venice in 95, I think, and got a lot of attention. And for me, it was just something completely different. He had been making movies since the late 80s, but he first and foremost was a comedian, and he was known for very strange comedy shows in Europe. And suddenly the first exposure that different exposure that people got of him was like this fairly serious, sensitive, but very violent drama about a police officer and who has to deal with his wife being terminally ill. That was the complete antithesis to anything Hollywood had to show. And that kind of really opened my eyes to like the wider world of cinema, that you can do things very differently to how Hollywood shoots his movies. The lighting a lot more natural, the framing very different, very like one point symmetrical, like this full-on shot, something you've never really seen in Hollywood, interspersed by a lot of paintings that are done by one of the characters that is in a wheelchair, but which are really the paintings that Kitano did himself. So it's kind of like, again, maybe not a single work. I mean, the movie is fantastic, and I recommend it to everybody. But it was kind of like a very like a milestone in terms of the kind of stuff I was exposed to, and that really put me on a path more than like watching anime and reading manga or whatever. More than anything, this kind of stuff put me really on a different path in life, and that's why it has a very different, very very special meaning to myself again. Before we let me do another one before we get into again a bit of Hong Kong cinema. I wanted to quickly talk about another one. Now we're getting in really into classic territory. Okay, it's opening, and the frame is tiny, which is Tokyo Story. From 1953, I think. So we're really talking about a classic here of world cinema, and by a director called Yasujirō Ozu. And he's very famous for really dealing a lot, because he did movies from the 30s to the 60s. He dealt with a lot of post-war development in Japan, also a lot of urbanization, people moving from the countryside into the bigger cities like Tokyo. And that's what the story is also about parents coming to see their kids in Tokyo and being confronted with how different life has become in the 1950s. A lot about like trains and modernization and cramped living conditions and all these sort of things that people really experienced back in the day. And I saw this in university and when I was studying Japanese and we were really exposed to a lot of different things. And out of my own interest, I started watching these movies. One of the interesting bits about him is that there's a fantastic documentary about him done by Wim Wenders, the famous German director, which I highly recommend everybody to watch if you're into this kind of movie. And one of the things he did was, you can see like very, very graphic, very strong compositions, a lot of silhouetting, and just how he shot things was just quite amazing. And like the framing, making things look open or tight, or framing people within frames and all these kind of things. And one of the things he did was always, when it comes to interiors, I'm trying to find one. Yeah, like this, he would always shoot from the height of the table. And the tables in traditional Japanese houses are quite low because people would sit at them or kneel at them and not sit on a chair. And which would create quite an intimate atmosphere. And he even, I think, got special tripods built for it. And he had such an intimate relationship with the main actresses and the main actors with which he did like countless of movies that I think one of the reasons why one of the really famous actresses that he always did movies with, she retreated from public life and she never acted again after the director died, even though she wasn't that old. That kind of like really like showed me a different aspect of filmmaking. So like I talked a lot about technical expertise and this and lighting and cinematography, but I mean there can be a lot more to it than that. There can be tight personal relationships between actors and directors. There can be like interesting technical aspects to again communicate a story in a different way, and all these sort of things and that even existed way before like any of the movies that I was watching then, which was again mostly Hollywood. And it was these movies are very different. They're very different to look, to sit through, to look through, to be entertained on a different level. And again, that was quite eye-opening, I think, that there's a lot more to movie making than the explosions and the satisfaction of seeing bad guys, I don't know, getting killed or crazy special effects, right? That there's
ultimately special stories, right? I mean, being able to be in a story that's saying something coming from the heart,
yeah.
You know,
and it doesn't even seems yeah it doesn't even have to be like a complicated story or something with a lot of twists and turns that keeps you at the edge of your seat, right? No. It just can be like a simple story, but it all depends on how it's told.
I think that's a really good point also as well for people who are actually doing art.
Mm.
To heed that comment that you just said, it's just how you're telling the story, and it's not always sort of has, you know, some things are better left in subtlety. Some things, you know, do you really need to have that person shooting that person in the face? Are there other ways to tell this story? Hopefully some of this cinematography will help them investigate.
Actually, that's something I wanted to mention for Seven as well, that most of the violence and the gruesomeness of Seven is actually only hinted at. It's never shown how any of the victims die. It's never shown what they did. It's only the result, and the rest is kind of like in the mind of the viewer, and that's something really powerful, I think.
Yeah, you should be able to sort of just present them with something, and they look at it and they draw their own conclusions. Mm-hmm. But you give them a little bit of a helping hand.
Exactly, just enough. Cool. Let's move on to your last movie, and then I have also something by the same director, but a bit earlier, I think.
Okay, and then we'll wrap it after that, I guess.
I have one last step that I want to talk about.
Sure.
But then, yes, cool. Okay, so you have The Grandmaster.
Yeah, so Grandmaster by Wong Kar-wai. Yeah. You know, I've always loved his, you know, all the cinematography that's gone on with his films. And they, I think it's, I don't know if the same person, but it's usually the same kind of look. And you know, this was, you know, this is, I think this is his latest film. I don't think he's done one after this.
I think he did one, but I forgot.
Yeah, or maybe he's still working. This is the last one I've seen. And I just, you know, I love the compositions in it. I loved, you know, the story itself, it's of Ip Man, and I think a lot of people, you know, they know the popular series, but you know, it's a martial arts film, so it also has a special place in my heart because I used to learn that.
Oh, cool.
You know, before my accident, but you know, when I, it's just the palette, everything is so different, and he's embracing the Chinese culture. And I really like that it's really coming across. And it's just, it was very easy to find frames that look good. Mm-hmm. Basically, to me, this is like everywhere.
Yeah, it's a beautiful movie.
It was beautifully done. Is it his best film? I don't know. Honestly,
I would he's done a lot of. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, but in terms of like, I think polish. This is the most polished film that I've seen.
Yeah, definitely.
But some of the other ones really... the feel of his older films have a nostalgic feel. And we'll see your pick and we'll talk about that. But it's just like... This is quite, you know, sort of polished Hollywood kind of...
Yeah. With a different sensibility though, right? I mean, he did a romantic love story... in Hollywood, right? I don't know if it was really Hollywood or just in an English speaking country, but that didn't go really well.
I don't know about that one.
Yeah, it's not worth watching. I don't know what happened there.
But I mean, you know, this is just, you know, a beautiful movie and a good movie.
Yeah, the opening sequence is fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, check it out if you haven't. But, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here that's just really looks amazing. Cool.
So let's go kind of a few years back. And I think it's his most well-known movie, In the Mood for Love. And it was kind of, I think the end chapter of kind of his earlier work, although he did that follow-up, like spiritual follow-up called 2046. But I think this is really the pinnacle of like his Hong Kong based stuff. I mean, there was one before, which was Chongqing Express, which got a lot of publicity because I think Quentin Tarantino said it's one of his favorite movies. It's also worth checking out, but this is really there is such a tight synergy between the picture, the story, and the music, that you cannot divorce one without you can't see one without the other. And I mean, it's essentially a love story between two married people living in Hong Kong in the 60s, dealing with all sorts of, again, societal pressure and living conditions, and what your parents expect from you and these kind of things. And it's just incredibly rich. And I think it has same cinematographer, which is like an expat Brit called Christopher Doyle, and I think he did The Grandmaster as well. It's just again one of those things that I think I saw it in cinema, and at that point, again, it got a lot of I think international attention. That I was really, like, really open to it and soaked up all this stuff. So, I mean, this is just it's an incredibly deep movie as well. Not only in terms of the topic that it talks about, but the grasp of cinema, of storytelling, of framing, of colors, of patterns, and what they all mean and can mean, right? The use of all these techniques while you have to work in like tiny spaces with like mirroring and framing and shooting through other objects and all these multiple layers of, I mean, maybe it's just imagined meaning, but I mean, for me, there's a certain amount of like, not everything you see in a frame is 100% deliberate. I feel there's a lot of stuff that, which is more of a feeling, but also a feeling that the director of photography or the director himself can, like, realizes is there, and that they know how to amplify and then how to evoke the right emotion in the viewer. But then at the same time also leaving more room for interpretation, because, I mean, there's a certain satisfaction if you leave. I mean, for me personally, like, I don't like movies where everything is spelled out. Like, that's why I'm not a big fan of, like, let's say the recent, like, Star Wars stuff, because it kind of fills in all the gaps of the mystery. Whereas I think a good movie needs to be deliberately murky in its storyline or in its framing or whatever, that it leaves room for the viewer to add their own stories to it. And that's why not everything has to be spelled out. Not everything needs to be clear on screen. It can be in as little as like an expression of an actor, or like in the darkness in the background, right? And I think these subtleties is really something that is present in this movie, and also in something I'm going to show in a second here. So, I mean, this is
well.
Really,
let me
please.
I have something that's kind of interesting to add. You know, exactly with your point. He had a photographer on set, you know, in some of his earlier movies, and it's a guy named Wing Sha. I just dropped it on the chat for you to, if you want to look at it. But the thing is, there was a very funny story. He's been his photographer for a long time, like, you know, photographer, you know, shooting the set and all that kind of stuff. And he would say that there was one time at the beginning where he shot it, but he didn't really know how to use the camera that well. So it was out of focus. And that's all he had. And Wong Kar-wai saw it and loved it. And that became sort of the feel, like a little bit of out of focus was his signature, photographer. And now, you know, he's become quite well known himself. And he's now a director. You know, if you look through his stuff, you'll see, you know, Maggie Cheung and, you know, like the stuff from In the Mood for Love and all that. It's all in there. But it's just kind of funny how sometimes lo-fi is good. It's not always, doesn't have to be super high fidelity, polished. I mean, sometimes I find, like, if things are even just, don't worry that much about technical aspects. If you can get your feeling across, wow, that's ultimately
it's
the
most. It's not about the megapixel, right? It's not about the best lens you can.
And sometimes blurry is not a bad thing. I don't know why everybody keeps thinking that's a bad thing. But anyway, I just thought that was an interesting story because he told that story. It was just like, wow. That it's just funny that you know, but back then it was like, well, this is the roll of film, that's all I have. It's out of focus. And he goes, I love it. And now you're known for being the out of focus guy. It's just interesting.
If you look at the set dressing and everything, how the colors are matched and everything, like, I didn't even notice the painting of the apples with I think you can eat with the apples in the thing just below, and like everything is very deliberate and arranged. But yeah, anyway, there's a funny story about how all her dresses are matched to the environment she's in. That's something to take note of when you watch the movie a couple of times. It's really there, like how her dresses match to the wallpaper, to the curtains, to the color overall, and the offices and everything into the buildings. That's something really interesting to take note of. So I'm gonna make a bit of a jump into now at least in my internal clock, we're like at the late 90s, and we're jumping now into the early 2000s. And I don't want to bore you too much longer with this, but I just wanted to kind of mention two movies two movies that signify a certain move towards something else. The one is Memories of Murder, by the now super famous Bong Joon-ho, who just won the Oscar for Parasite. This was his third movie. And the first one actually that I saw, that is his second movie, was The Joint Security Area, about an incident at the South-North Korean border, which was at the same time my first exposure to a Korean movie, and also was one of the biggest shifts in Korean cinematic history, from kind of like a more isolated movie culture to really like doing things on a more global scale with better like cinematography, with directors who were more open to different things. And it was kind of like a big milestone for Korean cinema. So this one he did shortly after, and it's a story about a famous serial killer in the 1980s in South Korea. It's based on a true story. And it's kind of like, I feel like in a way, I think it's influenced by Seven, but it's added with a good dose of humor, which is something that the Koreans do exceptionally well, that they can combine a story about a serial killer with sort of like almost like a slapstick style humor that neither makes the movie into a comedy nor detract, like it doesn't make it too funny but not too serious either, but it manages to do that so well, and it's one of the trademarks, I think, of that director and of Korean cinema in general. The cinematography is great, the story is fantastic. It opened again like my eyes to a different side of cinema, because Korean cinema is quite different from Japanese cinema, and again quite different from Chinese. At the same time, there was also Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which got a lot of attention and Oscars, I think. And each, like you can kind of always like say from a more distance, you can say, oh, Asian cinema, but you really have to realize that all of them, whether it's Thai, Vietnamese, Chinese, Taiwanese, Hong Kong, Korea, Japan, they all have completely different kind of approaches and ways of doing movies and telling stories. And there's a lot of, like, because of all the very turbulent recent history that Korea had, there's a lot of politics, a lot of stuff involved, and often these movies are used as a way to break taboos and to go beyond the norms accepted by society. And on top of that, like Korean movies in cinema have, like, they're usually a lot that they are known for being very violent, but that's, I think, also because a lot of violence, like guns and knives and smoking and a lot of stuff is not allowed to be shown on TV. So you get a lot of that as kind of like a reaction, a lot of murder stories and violence and stuff on on the big movie screen. It has changed recently, but it's still, I mean, if you look at the movies from like the late 2000s, early 2010s, then you will see a lot of that. But again, like for me, a milestone in its storytelling and stuff. Again, cinematography not like wow, out of this world different, but a different way to use it in the same in the same service of a story. And the last one, which I wanted to talk about, is a recent. I think it won the Oscar for the best foreign movie, which is a movie called Shoplifters from Japan. The director has that's the wrong one. Has a long history of making movies. He comes actually from a documentary background, and I think it shows a lot in how he shoots. I don't know if I have the frame here. I think it shows in kind of like the way he shoots his movies or likes his movies to look. It's a very uneventful kind of documentary style of filmmaking, completely subservient to the stories and the actors within it. And this is the kind of cinema that I've come to appreciate more than anything. Like really taking all the gimmicks and everything away from the cinematography, still making it look good, right? There's still a lot of skill in set dressing, in costume design, in framing and blocking and all these kind of things, but it really takes a step back.
Like gimmick away in what way?
Like in a way you see, like there's a lot of like whatever you want to call it, like production value, like there's a lot of effort being put into like making everything as beautiful as possible. Like if you look at stuff like, again, like Seven or Raiders of the Lost Ark, right, it's there's a certain level of sophistication of everything like being where it needs to be, and yeah, having the production value consistently high and having always like a really polished, like perfect image at the end of it. Whereas, I mean, those movies are a good example of still having the balance of telling a good story. But then, I mean, there's plenty of examples that completely go the other way, like we said in the beginning, like telling, like just having pretty frames for the sake of it and not really doing much else. Not telling any story any better, not focusing on what's really important, just spending money for the sake of spending money. Whereas this goes the complete other way. Of course, they scout locations, but it's not like they go through great lengths of making those locations like the prettiest that it can be, because they also don't have the budget. But the entire focus of like the telling of a story is something that interests me way more, and making mm-hmm. due with what you have, and I don't know, the beauty in the everyday kind of thing. That's what I find a lot. Of course, it's very difficult to compare these two. I mean, maybe some people will say it's completely unfair to compare these two as movies. I mean, they're both movies, but that's pretty much the only thing they have in common. Because one sets out to maybe entertain purely or give you like a satisfaction, a short-lived satisfaction of having as much stuff blow up in your face as possible, whereas the other one is supposed to make you think and be a mirror to society, this kind of stuff, right? So maybe you can't compare them, but I mean, for me, in my book, I still compare them because they both compete for my time. They both want me to spend time on watching them. So if I then have the choice of dedicating two hours of my life towards watching something mindless, whereas watching something else, then I fully commit to watching something that is more meaningful. So in that sense, I tend to compare these two. And whether or not they have the most outstanding cinematography is, I think, not the main concern I have at this point.
So in the end, I mean, you could almost say, I mean, you know, in terms of like your own work, let's say, or other people's work, that, you know, getting the story and feeling and across is all actually more important than sort of the quote unquote gimmick, kind of like lens flares and crazy atmo and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
At a certain stage in my life, I got more satisfaction out of watching something explode, right? That is just natural. But I think in terms of where I am right now and in terms of my life, like I do favor other things. And I mean, that changes for everyone, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I mean, it's no secret. Everybody knows I've just recently did some personal work, but I'll just say that, you know, like that one, I took a lot of efforts not to do the gimmick smoke and lens flare and volumetric and all that. I mean, it was actually quite difficult in the sense that, you know, there's none of that. But it's more satisfying to me to play on subtlety now than it is and tell a story than it is just to go, oh, here, there's something exploding here. You know, something really bright, you know. I mean, not that there's no place for that, but
it is,
I think for now, I think that's where we're gravitating towards. I mean, I know I am. So it sounds like you are too. So
cool.
Yeah, awesome.
Okay, that was really interesting to I think we have enjoyed certainly sharing what kind of has been going on.
I enjoy seeing this.
In the back of our heads. So maybe you guys see a bit more. And I mean, I hope this was interesting to you guys to see, and hopefully you learned about some movies you haven't known before. We'll put the links to all. We will put an IMDb link or something to all the movies we have introduced here in the show notes. And we really strongly recommend you not only to check out these movies, but use them as a starting point to really broaden your horizon and learn more about different directors from different countries, and by that extension also about, I don't know, different cultures. And it can, God knows where this will all lead you. And if you have other movies that you think like, hey, I really love this movie and it means a lot to me, but maybe a lot of people don't know that, because I mean, we haven't really touched on really rich like history of movies like in like France or Italy or other parts of the world, because again, we can't cover everything, and this is just kind of our thing. So please let us know in the comments if you have some really cool stuff that you think other people should also watch. And again, if you enjoyed this episode, please like, comment, and subscribe, and we see you guys in the next one. Thank you.
See you. Bye.